Is it time to replace your home's carpet or flooring? Call Sears Flooring to get shop-at-home convenience you can trust. Sears Flooring brings the showroom to you with a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, and laminate. And if you call right now, you'll save 20%. Call for a free in-home consultation at 1-888-491-3939. Sears Flooring has many styles to match your home and your budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring right now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring. You'll save 20% if you call now. Call 1-888-491-3939. That's 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Well, today marks the sixth segment in our second annual franchise legal series, and it really has been a great series. And I really like to thank my co-producer Joe Caruso for putting together such a great series. A matter of fact, as a treat today, we have Joe on the line with us today. Joe, welcome to Franchise Today.
Great to be here, Paul.
You know, I'd like to give an overview to our listening audience today of kind of some of the background behind the show. I know we started out, you know, back on April 14th with Lane Fisher and progressed all the way through to last week when we talked about franchise broker issues with John Tifford. And it was a great show, and I know you and I have fielded numerous phone calls about the different issues. But, you know, as we go back and we look a little bit more than a year and a half ago, and you and I started talking about, you know, taking Franchise Today in a new direction and making it more compelling with issues that were specifically about franchise best practices. If you would, give me some of your thoughts behind, or share some of your thoughts behind, you know, the series, last year's series, four parts, this year's series, seven parts, and, of course, you know, many other attorneys wanting to get involved in this. Kind of give us a little bit of an insight into your thought process behind this whole thing.
Well, you know, in franchising, you know, the thing that binds all the disparate channels of distribution and different kinds of brands together is the legal construct of franchising. You know, there's not many associations that would include a plumbing Roto-Rooter type franchise and a haircutting place that would have much in common, or a fast food operation like Burger King and a maid service. Now, there's really no other relationship that binds those businesses together other than the fact that they are businesses. But when it's within the franchise context, they have a lot in common in terms of compliance with the law, the activities they engage in terms of inquiry and lead generation. And so it became, the franchise aspect of it was a broader issue that touched a lot of different business channels. And a lot of these people are focused on what they do and not so much focused on the aspect of being a franchisor and best practices of being a franchisor in staying in compliance with the law and running great franchise organizations. So if you're committed to building durable and sustainable franchise systems, you need to know this stuff. And in talking with a lot of the franchise attorneys that I've known in the 20 years of being in franchising, you know, they lament oftentimes the lack of knowledge or the complacency that occurs. And they regularly would discuss issues that they thought were important. And I thought, after talking with you, that it would be a great idea to bring some of these folks on, let them talk about their thoughts on franchising. We've done some important shows. We've done some important shows. We've done them twice, and they weren't repetitive. They were just add-ons to the preview shows. For example, having Lane Fisher on doing FPRs. FPRs are a hot topic in franchising. They're also very confusing for franchisors, and drilling down and enlightening them and dispensing with the mythology and some of the romanticism of certain aspects of franchising, in particular FPRs, was very valuable. So I think that was the genesis of the whole thing. And, you know, last year's series went so well, and everybody wanted to do it again, and the audience seemed to respond so favorably. I think that kind of sums it up.
Well, you know, and it's been a great series. We have had increased listenership, both live and on demand. But as a parent, by a troubling email that I saw this morning, that even thought that it should go into our "Are You Kidding Me?" segment, but it's really even more important than that, because certainly it's not something to discuss tongue-in-cheek. And I'd like to read it, because you talked about FPRs, and apparently, you know, some people just still are not getting this. And the email obviously went out to franchise candidates, and it said, "As an employee of the blank corporate office, I am unable to give out financial information about our stores. However, we'll be holding a validation conference call with one of our current franchisees on this coming Wednesday, May 18th at 8 p.m. This is an open forum call, and the franchisee will be answering any and all questions you might have, including ones about the financials of their store and their experience with blank. If you're interested in attending, I will first need a completed application. I've attached the application to this email, which can be faxed or emailed back to me. Please note, if there's any information on the application you do not feel comfortable sharing at this time, please leave it blank. I only need the document, so I may get you access to our private financial information." Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that is an improper FPR.
It is troubling, and I think it goes back to why we do the legal series, why we do Franchise Today. These kinds of things kind of take on a life of their own. I mean, you're at a franchising event with other franchisors, or you're listening to a speaker talk about lead generation or franchise sales process, and people say, "Well, geez, I don't have an earnings claim, and I can't get through to my leads. I can't get them involved and engaged in the process. I need some things." And then some bright person comes up with this idea. And, you know, it's an obvious circumvention of the intent of what an FPR has to be. And, in fact, saying that they can't give it to you in the first part of that email is, I think, untrue. So we want to really be, you know, mythbusters on some of this stuff, and give people ways that they actually can do things. It's not good enough having a show like Franchise Today and a legal series and saying to people, "Here are all the things you can't do. If you, you know, here are all the problems. If you don't have the attendant solutions to go along with it, and here's what you shouldn't do and can't do, and here are the things you can do to really make and build a durable and sustainable franchise system using best practices in a compliant way."
Absolutely. And today, you know, we've brought on another attorney, Adam Siegelheim. Adam is an associate and member of the business and corporate and franchise groups. His practice includes the representation of the companies and nonprofit organizations on a variety of issues, including entity formation, financing, intellectual property, real estate mergers and acquisitions, and insurance coverage matters. And his franchise practice includes the representation of franchisors and master franchisees in various matters, including the preparation of disclosure documents and franchise agreements, state registrations, and compliance with applicable federal and state regulations. Adam just recently attended the IFA Legal Symposium 2011 in Washington. Adam, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul. How are you?
good, and it's good to hear your voice again. Haven't seen you since the International Franchise Expo, and of course, you know, Joe Caruso, my co-producer and good friend, is on the line as well. And so say hello.
Hello, Joe.
Adam, always great to talk with you. I can't wait to hear what you have to say about the legal symposium.
Well, I'm looking forward to this next hour. Thank you guys for having me on.
Well, thank you for taking the time out of your day. I know being out of the office for a few days, your time's got to be very valuable later in the week, such as right now. So why don't we just dive right into it? If you would, Adam, you know, give us, you know, what was the overall sentiment behind the symposium, the people that were there? What was the buzz about initially and then as the symposium progressed along?
Well, you know, what continues to be a very passionate topic amongst the attendees at the symposium, and for those of you who are not familiar, a few years back the symposium moved from the Capitol Hilton to the JW Marriott in downtown D.C., and Joe and Paul, I don't know if you've ever stayed at the JW Marriott down there, but the elevator bank continues to be a very passionate topic amongst the attendees. They have got this elevator bank that people either love or hate. Basically, the way it works is when you go to the elevator bank and an elevator's there, you don't necessarily get on it. You type in the floor you're going to, and the computer tells you what elevator to go to. I actually think it's great, you know, because what it does is you have two people there, and one's going to the 10th floor and one's going to the 18th floor. They'll tell you, you go on A, this one goes on E, elevator E, and it just shoots you right up to your floor, and you don't have to wait and so forth. But for whatever reason, people tend to either hate this thing or they absolutely love it. It's very polarizing.
I know why they charge so much a room. I know when I was checking rooms for the IFE, what was that, the beginning of April,
yep,
the end of March, and I called the JW Marriott and I said, I need your rate. You know, I'm going to be there for 5 nights because we were staying for the Small Business Lending Summit. And without blinking an eye, very, very, very confident, and said, oh, our rate is $7.89.
It's unbelievable.
I said, excuse me? I said, and then tax title and license the whole 9 years? She goes, yeah. And I said, well, what about the friends and family rate? Because we have some relatives that work for Marriott. And she said, oh, hold on a minute. She goes, oh, that's $5.99. I said, do you know I could go on for several days to Costa Rica, including airfare for that rate? And she said, well, yeah, okay. So now I know why.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, in Costa Rica, you're not going to get that elevator bank. it's actually, I mean, the best advice I can give people is if there's a conference you want to attend to, reserve your hotel room right away under the room block for whoever's running that conference, because otherwise you get into that situation where you happily call up, you know, the reserve a room under the $299 a night room block rate, and that's sold out, but good news, we got you for $700 a night.
Yeah, well, I think it's their way of telling us that $299 is a bargain, right?
But believe me, it's definitely that's the value of joining the IFA right there. Yeah, I suppose it was actually really interesting. I've kind of had a similar feel to the expo that the three of us had attended a month or two back, where you could really kind of feel a little more balance in people's steps. People feel the economy is kind of moving in the right direction. I don't think anybody would tell you that the economy has completely bounced back. I mean, all you have to do is watch the news to know that that's not the case. And with franchising being so heavily tied to the credit markets, you know, that's probably going to be one of the last industries to fully recover. It's going to have to lag behind the banks, you know, lending again with a more robust lending program. But at least you do get the sense of walking around the symposium over the last few days that there is a sense of optimism. People feel that things are going in the right direction. And I think that gives the confidence to a lot of these franchise companies when they're making decisions to bring on that head of development that they've been holding off on bringing, or bringing on more personnel, or aggressively going back into marketing to try to get more deals done, because they feel that there's more of a chance that these deals are going to happen now as things start to soften a bit.
Sure, Joe. I know you spend a lot of time in the capital city, attending various association meetings and franchise business network groups. and obviously meet a lot of attorneys. As a matter of fact, the first thing I'd like to say is congratulations to your appointment to president of the Capital Area Franchise Association. Is some of the same sentiment, are you seeing that in the association and business network groups as Adam saw at the symposium?
I think in a phrase, it's cautiously optimistic. I think that people are not seeing the inquiry and lead flow that they did at one time, but I think that they are talking to, as a percentage of the people that they do talk to, more buyers. And they are hopeful, and in terms of financing getting better, although it's not anywhere near what it was, you know, pre-economic downturn.
You know, Adam, in preparation for the show, we talked a little bit, and you were kind enough to share some of your notes from the symposium. And you mentioned in here that the sessions at the symposium seem to incorporate more business themes than has been typical in the past. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that these symposiums, every year the IFA has their legal symposium around this time, and in the fall the American Bar Association has their forum on franchising, which is a very similar program. And when you're attending these, you know, year after year, twice a year, some of the sessions start to feel like they're just kind of become recycled. And one of the things I thought they made a really good effort with the symposium this year, the organizers really tried to focus on some of the business aspects of franchising, which to me is a great way to go because, first off, it kind of puts a new angle into the sessions. And second, attorneys, when they're advising clients, you can't just advise your client in the vacuum of only the legal considerations. You do have to factor in the business considerations and kind of blend that in with your advice so that you're giving proper legal advice that also has a practical aspect. So it was interesting to see some of the sessions that really were sessions that they were just as informative for an attorney as a franchise executive. So, for example, one of the sessions was, I didn't attend it, but I had saw it in the materials, different practices to collect past due royalty amounts and just very practical things that you're going to want to know if you're the CFO or president of a franchise company, and certainly different practice pointers for attorneys as well. So I thought they did a excellent job of really kind of trying to weave in business themes into the legal sessions.
Now, you also mentioned NASA working on a couple of interesting projects. What exactly are they working on?
Yeah.
And when I talk about NASA, I'm not talking about the space agency.
Yeah,
right?
they're actually talking about going to Mars. No, this is the Security Association. And Dale Cantone, who is the head of NASA, was in one of the sessions, and he had mentioned that one of the things they're working on is a commentary for multi-unit franchising. There's no standard, you know, when someone says area developer or sub-franchisor, not everybody's on the same page of what that person is talking about. So one of the things they were talking about doing was having standard definitions for different terminology that the whole country can go by. And also kind of drilling down and giving their input on the disclosure documents in terms of what's actually required to be disclosed for each item when you're doing multi-unit franchising. So that's definitely a hot item that people are going to look forward to reviewing. I subscribe to the American Bar Association's listserv through the Forum on Franchising, where attorneys and other professionals who are part of the listserv are able to shoot comments and questions back and forth, and you do see that periodically popping up with people trying to get guidance from other attorneys on, you know, if this person is doing this, are they technically an area developer or not? You know, does this need to be disclosed? So I think it's definitely going to be very welcome to see NASA weigh in on all that. The other thing that they were talking about doing was an electronic registry for state registrations. kind of, they didn't go into much details, but one of the things I took away from it was they were kind of looking at what Wisconsin was doing, of the ability to be able to electronically file the registration online and having some kind of service that could potentially be used for all the states. That seemed to still be in kind of the early process, and they hadn't really figured out from a budgetary standpoint, from a technology standpoint, but just one of the things that they're working on. So that obviously would be another very welcome change, you know, when that came to fruition.
But with respect to the definitions regarding, you know, area developers, master franchisees, et cetera, and all the terminology that's used out there, how close are they to actually implementing this type of action?
They did not give a timeline. They
okay.
just basically said they're in the process of doing it. And obviously it's going to come out as advisory when it does come out. And then at that point, the states will determine on a case-by-case basis if they're going to adopt it. But he did they didn't give any indication of when this would be coming about, only that they were working on it.
Sure, Joe, and I know you're probably thinking the same thing, that they probably need to come up with a definition for franchise consultants and franchise brokers as well, right?
Well, it'd probably be a good idea, but getting back to I'm glad that Dale and NASA are addressing this, because it is an area of confusion, and I also subscribe to the ABA Forum on Franchising Listserv, and you can go back into the archives. And it's a perennial question. You can go back years and people ask the same question over again.
Yep.
Whether someone is a development agent, whether they're an area developer, whether they are a sub-franchisor. And more importantly, if you're a development agent, are you required to have your own disclosure document if you're sub-franchising in an area? Or are you going to use the franchisor's franchise disclosure document? And it really depends. And it would be nice to get some clarification on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's really scary. As most know, that I spent a little time consulting in the commercial cleaning industry, janitorial industry, and seeing some of the master franchisees having their own disclosure documents and actually being expected to follow franchise sales best practices when selling unit level franchises at, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 down is just I cringe when I think about it, and it's no wonder that the state of Massachusetts took action against one of the major commercial cleaning franchisors with respect to an alternative workforce. It's really complicated. So I am happy to see that NASA is working on defining these specific terms. Adam, did they mention anything about their views on advertising, about marketing, especially in today's day and age when online and social media marketing is so prevalent?
They actually there was a session that you typically see Ask the Regulators, where they'll have different regulators from various states, plus a representative from the FTC was on the panel. And they did actually weigh in on their thoughts on advertising, and it was pretty interesting, because you know, you get to hear right from the horse's mouth in terms of how they're thinking. And I think what I found was a little striking is that it was really very specific to the regulator. There definitely was not uniformity for the most part in terms of, you know, they were actually disagreeing with each other on the panel in certain cases as to whether or not something was permitted or not permitted. You know, one of the things that they got into was more and more people are using rankings. And, you know, they're basically anytime you're awarded, you know, number one sub in, you know, North Dakota, or, you know, no matter what the local newspaper ranks you the best steakhouse in the town, and people are incorporating that into their advertising. And some of the regulators didn't like that, because they felt that these rankings were not very legitimate. You know, in some cases, the best steakhouse might be the best steakhouse because they're also the number one advertiser for that newspaper, and they just happen to be the number one ranked steakhouse as well. So some of them viewed these rankings with suspicion, and I think the takeaway was if you are going to incorporate references to rankings, you should substantiate them with footnotes and give the regulator comfort as to where you got this from and the legitimacy. You know, something, you know, common sense, you know, avoid statements that cannot be validated. You know, they will permit puffery to a certain extent, but as long as it doesn't go overboard. So, you know, one of the examples they put up was the greatest sub you'll ever eat. A couple of the regulators kind of raised their eyebrows and they were a little bit concerned with it. Other regulators just considered it permissible puffery and they were fine with it. They also, you know, made sure that people, you know, one of their pet peeves was, or not pet peeve, but one of the things that they were concerned about was franchise companies not submitting their advertising materials, waiting the review period, and then using them. So they're making sure that if you are going to be using advertising materials in states that require a review, that they do go in, you know, X amount of business days ahead of time. It's usually a short period. The other thing is obviously, you know, being cautious that you're not putting financial performance representations in your advertised materials that are not contained in the disclosure document. Some states, you know, they do not want any financial performance representations at all. In other states, it's fine as long as it's within the item 19. In terms of the internet and website advertising, you know, for the most part, they're fine with that. As long as there's disclaimers, it's not being offered in registration states. It's not being directed to residents in a certain state where a franchise company didn't register yet. And as long as the franchise company is complying with the registration requirements before selling, they're generally fine with the website advertising.
Joe, you know, you and I have talked in the past. It's funny that Adam mentioned steakhouses because as we both travel a bunch, we often see, you know, the 10 best steakhouses of Chicago or the 10 best steakhouses of you know, Florida. And, of course, they're the independent ones. And as Adam said, you know, they might not be legitimate rankings. And I think this also lends over towards what we've talked about in the past about all these advertorials that are out there where people are pointing candidates to look for information. And certainly the whole process is not scientific. Do you have any questions for Adam with respect to any of that, or maybe give us a little bit of your insight?
No, I have a comment. I mean, and I think the analogy between the 10 best steakhouses nationwide in the Delta magazine on the airplane, you know, it's those are paid placements. And
right.
I don't think anybody will argue that they're paid placements. There are also companies that will do franchisee satisfaction reviews and franchise business reviews of your franchise, but you pay for them. And I mean, the question becomes on them, it's less clear, are they empirically and correct? Is there a methodology that gives you a fair outcome, or are these simply just paid for testimonials under the guise of a business review or survey? I mean, anybody can. I can make a survey come out great if I get to pick the questions.
It's actually interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the regulators that came up during the session, and one of the regulators did specifically note that if there is any kind of ranking or any kind of survey or, you know, things that you were talking about that were commissioned by the franchise company, the regulator would request the backup in terms of what questions were asked and, you know, would want to see all the survey results and really want to drill down and try to fish around and make sure that it was legitimate and not just, as you were saying, something that was crafted by the franchisor to elicit certain responses so that they would have it.
We know there's all kinds of squabble that went on with respect to blogs, and the FTC came out with some rulings on that. And, you know, these are just basically paid endorsements, the way they've twisted it to be able to be presented the way they wanted it to be presented.
Yeah, and this is this is great conversation, because this is the essence of why we do the Franchise Today show, and in particular the legal series, because this is information that franchisors, franchise executives, and professionals need to have, because a lot of these activities seem benign, they seem innocent, they seem casual, but they can have consequences to your franchise company that could be devastating, especially if you're a small franchisor. If you're a large franchisor, you might have created more problems with individual franchisees, but this could put a franchisor out of business if these activities persisted over time and they sold a bunch of franchises, say, in California, and California decides, hey, you know what, you got to offer all these people rescission. I'm not sure that small franchisor could pay that bill.
Yeah, I don't think so. And if people want to know a little bit more about rescission, may I refer them back to an earlier segment on Franchise Today with Warren Lee Lewis, as we were talking about franchise sales best practices. And also, Adam, and I want to jump to the back of your notes with respect, because we just mentioned social media.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioning your notes, enforcement of social media and how employment cases are actually starting to pave the way. Can you give us a little bit of your thoughts behind that?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was interesting is I attended a breakout session on enforcing social media policies, and when they introduced the panel, they were all employment attorneys, which makes sense if you think about it, because generally if a company is having an issue with social media postings, there's a good likelihood that it's going to be a disgruntled or a former employee that's posting that stuff. So it kind of makes sense that the employment attorneys are on the front lines of this. And it also makes sense that what the courts decide in those cases are going to likely be relied upon when courts are deciding similar issues in franchise cases. You know, we recently had a case here in New Jersey with Houston's restaurant up in Hackensack, New Jersey. And the manager, and this is this obviously, you know, strikes me as it went back a few years, because it was dealing with MySpace, and a private group had formed on there of employees of the Houston's location, and one of the employees was a little friendly with one of the managers and showed them the back and forth that was going on there. And the manager asked for the login details so he could manage it, and the employee complied. And the manager started to read everything and, you know, came across inappropriate sexual comments about coworkers and customers, references to drugs, negative comments about the company and its policies. And the manager ended up firing two of the people who were driving a lot of the postings. And the employees ended up suing Houston's, and they prevailed. And, you know, they basically prevailed on a invasion of privacy claim. And, you know, what the court found was that the manager, by getting the access to the site, it was basically through coercion that the employee would fear the consequences if she didn't turn that information over to the manager and let the manager log on. So the manager kind of bullied his way in through his power as a supervisor at Houston's, and you know, basically came on under her login and was able to monitor this stuff. So, you know, there's a situation where you have a you know, the employee saying, you know, negative stuff, and obviously we you know, franchisors are no strangers to franchisees getting together and going back and forth either verbally or through some kind of electronic means, whether it be a social media site or some bulletin board, blasting the franchisor, and it's not uncommon for the franchisor to get access. And this would kind of lead me to believe that, you know, franchisor may not be able to take the actions it would emotionally want to take when you kind of look at this case.
Right. And you know, obviously we hear a lot of different experiences and circumstances that are, oh my God, type of situations like that. But I know Joe and I, in talking with Jonathan Redgrave, who was on the show, I think it was our second segment and was also in this year's series and was also on back in the fall talking about social media and eat discovery. And we talked, Joe, I think, if you recall, about LinkedIn and the and probably just the very honest approach of giving somebody a recommendation on LinkedIn, and whether it be for somebody that was a former employee or something along those lines, and then all of a sudden it gets twisted into employment issues. And, of course, we know in LinkedIn we've seen, you know, earnings claims. I mean, you know, some of them are the less than obvious, oh, my God, moments like you just described, Adam. And I think, you know, going back to Jonathan on Franchise Today in the second series, it really was quite frightening. I think, Joe, tell me if I'm right, he even confirmed that every tweet that's out there is being archived in the National Library of Congress. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what he stated on the show, and I think it's important his comments to the question about LinkedIn recommendations and what if a company has a policy that says we don't give recommendations to former employees. And you've got had a great relationship with your boss or your subordinate or your peer, and you get them to write you a glowing LinkedIn recommendation, and you've just been severed from the company. What problems could that pose? And they were myriad. I mean, he explained a number of things that could come up, and I'm not going to rehash what he said, but it's certainly problematic. I think all of this stuff falls under the category of casualness. I remember back in the 90s that I had to go through a seminar with attorneys on email. And it was the goal of this particular seminar was to dispel the notion that emails are casual. Emails are important. Emails carry the same weight as writing someone a letter, and you need to be careful about what you say. I think that is coming to bear in the realm of social media, and it's going to be tenfold, because with email, all you had to worry about was who forwarded it to someone else. With Twitter, it's going to everybody, and it takes on a life of its own, and now you have the Library of Congress keeping track of it.
You know, Adam, we mentioned Twitter, and I was so excited to see you on Twitter back at the IFA convention in Vegas, and actually saw you tweeting, although you've really taken a back seat to it since then, haven't you?
I definitely have not been a good not good with my tweets.
Adam, I know there
I'm still trying to figure out how to do it.
Well, the next time I'm up in the area, the next time we're at a conference, we'll have to sit down together and do so. And I know at the conference, the symposium, there had to be a lot of discussion about material changes, you know, with respect to the FDD. If you would, give us a little bit of insight of what the discussions were about.
Yeah, actually, one of the interesting things was that, you know, typically when you go to these symposiums or the Forum on Franchising through the ABA, there'll be some type of sales compliance session where they'll discuss changes and whether or not they're material and whether you have to update the disclosure document. They actually had a complete hour and 15-minute breakdown session where they really drilled down on what constitute material changes and when you have to change. That was definitely interesting and kind of really, you know, for someone who's constantly attending these sessions, great for people in my boat who have kind of been sitting through these year after year to kind of see some new stuff here. I mean, you know, the basic premise of, you know, when something's material and when it needs to be changed in your FDD is would, you know, if you just kind of ask yourself, if I'm the one who's going to be buying this franchise, would I want to know about that? Would that affect my decision? And if the answer is yes, a reasonable person, if they were looking at this investment, would want to know about it or should know about it, then that's a material change, and it has to be your FDD needs to be updated to incorporate that. Now, there's this tension, this short-term versus long-term tension, because in the short term, by having to kind of stop the process, update your FDD, potentially filing a post-effective amendment in registration states, time kills deals, and that could cost you a sale. Plus, not to mention the filing fees and the cost to update the documents. But again, when you're kind of looking at the long term, the fact that you're taking care of it and you're reducing your chance of any kind of problems or litigation, you would have to say that that would obviously far outweigh any of the short term issues. But when you're looking at it from the business side, and generally decisions to update are not made by the attorneys. They're usually made by the senior management of the franchise companies based on the input of their attorney, and they kind of factor in the legal consequences and think about the business considerations and make a decision. So it always does weigh back and forth of that short-term, potential loss versus, the long-term benefits. One of the things that they kind of drilled down on as they went through the session are just some common things that people don't always realize would trigger a material change to your disclosure document and would require a update. The one on top of the list was a material change in the franchisor's financial situation. So if something had happened where the finances looked good for the franchisor and then during the course of the year something bad happened, let's say, for example, you have a your franchisees are kind of scattered on the Gulf Coast, and with the BP oil spill, it hurt their ability to get fish, and they're a seafood business, and it hurt tourism. And as a result, the revenues went down for the franchisees, which meant revenues went down for the franchisor, and the franchisor's financial picture is completely different than what the financials from the year before showed based on this catastrophic event. That could potentially trigger an update. Obviously, if there's a bankruptcy filing, some major litigation, some unexpected changes to the initial investment, that would potentially trigger having to update. Some states, your loss of franchisees potentially trigger. In some states, they do it by a percentage, where if a certain percentage of your franchisees go away, you need to update item 20. So these are all things that franchise companies usually don't think about as the year is progressing, but need to think about because it could result in fines and penalties by the applicable states.
Joe, in our preparation for today's show, we were going over Adam's notes. You had raised the question that you were surprised that there was so much financial discussions going on. And I noticed in Adam's notes, it talks about the SBA, the focus on franchise agreements. Did you have some questions for Adam with respect to that?
Well, what do you think the genesis of it was in a legal symposium to be so devote so much time and energy to the financing piece where in the past it hadn't been there? What do you think caused it, and what did they talk about?
You're referring to the session dealing with the SBA?
Correct.
That was actually really interesting. That was the first time they had done it. Very well attended. It was an hour and 15-minute breakout session that really could have gone on for hours and hours. The panelists were just getting pelted with questions from the attendees the entire time. At a certain point, the moderator just had to put a stop to questions because they just were not going to get anywhere near through the material that they wanted to cover, and they definitely did not get through a big chunk of the material because of that. So I think it's actually it was a great session. I think it's going to be repeated. Now, they kind of approached it from a legal standpoint, where they basically said, franchise companies are becoming more and more reliant on SBA financing in order to open up new units. And, you know, some of the things that are involved are getting on the SBA registry, and then also as part of that process, the SBA is going to review the franchise agreement, and certain things may not fly from the SBA's perspective, and they're going to want you to change that. So that was really the crux of why they were presenting this at a legal symposium of when you're drafting your franchise agreements, here are some considerations you need to think about that the SBA is going to be taking a good hard look at that may result in your client, when you're drafting the FDD, having issues of getting on the SBA registry. So that was kind of the genesis.
What are some of the things they indicated that they would focus on in the franchise agreement?
Well, the big thing was control issues were a very big theme that the presenters talked about. You know, they wanted to make sure that it was truly an independent business. And, I mean, Paul, you had talked earlier about consulting in the janitorial services industry, where some people have argued that they're glorified employees, that's not really their own independent business based on the way it's structured in terms of the franchisor getting the jobs, doing the billing, and just paying, you know, the franchisees from that. So, I mean, those are issues that the SBA looks at, and they want to make sure, because if it's not a truly independent business, then they're affiliated with the franchise company, and at that point, if they're not really separated, are they truly a small business as defined, you know, under the SBA guidelines and eligible for SBA financing? So they are really looking at, you know, they want the franchisee to have the ability to profit from their hard work and, you know, bear the risk of loss and not just be and have it really be their own company, not just a glorified employee of the franchisor. One of the things that came up were people were asking about, well, what about stepping rights? And stepping rights is when, you know, due to some kind of dramatic circumstances, the franchisor does not feel that the franchisee is able to run the business, and the franchisor is going to step in for a management fee. So that could be, you know, in a situation where there's a disability. You know, franchisee gets hit by a bus, he's in a coma for a month, no one knows what's going to happen, who's running the business, the franchisor can step in. Or there's some kind of egregious mismanagement going on and the franchisor is concerned. And, the SBA was pretty much not going to prevent a franchisor from having these step-in rights as long as they weren't permanent and that they were reevaluating every 60, 90 days whether these circumstances have changed and giving a opportunity for the franchisee to step back in. Also wanted to make sure that the franchisee was controlling their own employees, they were controlling their own money, that revenue was not flowing to an account controlled by the franchisor or a third party, and then being paid to the franchisee, that the revenues were coming directly to the franchisees. You know, someone raised an issue of, like, well, what about national accounts, where the franchisor has a national account set up, and it's basically set up that if the franchisee does work, the franchisor gets paid because they're the ones that have the national account, and then they divvy it up based on who did work in what markets. That was fine as long as these national accounts were not a substantial part of the franchisee's business, and it wasn't that most of their money was going to these franchisor-controlled accounts. Another thing that they had brought up was the right of first refusal. You know, if something happened when the franchisee was going to sell, that the franchisor had the right of first refusal. That was fine as long as they didn't have a option to buy, which means that the franchisee doesn't want to sell, and the franchisor could force it. That was not okay. The other thing was you could have an option to buy assets, you know, equipment, product supplies, as long as it was for fair market value. So that was fine. You know, they did not want partial transfers, you know, for the franchisor to be able to step in where all of a sudden now the franchisor owns 35% or 55% of the franchise company. They really wanted it to be all or nothing if the franchisor was going to exercise any right of first refusal. I actually found it very, very interesting because clients, we're finding that they are gravitating. If they haven't been on the SBA registry, they feel that this is, they feel a compelling need to get on there. And I'm noticing that our newer clients, they're making the jump to the SBA registry or trying to make the jump much earlier in their franchise life nowadays than they may have maybe would have waited longer prior to this recession hitting. So it was great hearing their comments because more and more of our agreements are being reviewed by the SBA nowadays.
Adam,
Yes.
Who's actually reviewing the agreements?
Well,
I mean, is it just the bank attorneys, or are there actually the bankers themselves, or a combination thereof?
Well, it probably, the answer is, like a lot of times when you ask a lawyer, is it depends. So if you're trying to get on the SBA registry, what you'll do is you'll work with Fran Data, who will basically be the liaison between you and the SBA, and Fran Data will kind of work with you to present all the information that you need in the way that the SBA wants it, and they'll kind of help you to navigate. And at that point, you know, the SBA is going to be reviewing the agreements, and you know, they have their own in-house counsel that has the final say on if you disagree with something that comes back. But generally, you'll get an addendum back from their in-house counsel or from someone there, and it goes from there. If you're not on the SBA registry, it doesn't necessarily mean that a franchisee is not going to be able to get an SBA loan. It's just going to be an extra step because the lender is going to have to get involved, and then they'll have to contact the SBA. And at that point, it would, you know, might be a different person that reviews the agreement who's focusing more on that loan for the SBA, since they're,
sure,
since you're not pre-approved on the registry.
Joe, any other questions with respect to the SBA and franchise finance?
Yeah, Adam, in my conversations with sidebar conversation with other franchise attorneys other than yourself, people have had a little bit of angst over the bank credit report.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go on record right now. I'm a proponent of people using the bank credit report. I think it's a very valuable tool. But the criticism has been that it could be, or it is, in other people's opinions, that it's an end run around an earnings claim. And the conversation typically goes as, well, the franchisor doesn't have an item 19 financial performance representation in the disclosure document,
mm-hmm,
but yet they have detailed financial information in the bank credit report that the bank swears to confidentiality that they won't provide to the franchisee, yet they'll use it in determining whether or not they're going to provide that loan.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say that the people that have that criticism, they're not being nasty or ugly, but they have a good point.
I'm in the other camp. I do not think that there's an issue. If you are giving the credit report to the bank,
mm-hmm,
and it's subject to them signing a non-disclosure confidentiality agreement that they are not going to share that information to the with the franchisee, and you're,
mm-hmm,
just dealing directly with the lender, you know, I don't think there's anything you can point to in the disclosure laws that you would be violating at that point. As long as you have that Chinese wall set up between the lender and the franchisee, I would say that it's not an end run, and it's completely, I would say that it's a good practice in terms of, and it's probably, I mean, the reality is that these credit reports are probably becoming more and more necessary just given the climate right now. And the alternative is to say, okay, I'm going to be very conservative, and I am going to consider this an end run around the, you know, item 19, even though, you know, there's really nothing that I can point to that says it's an end run, and I'm not going to do that, and my franchisees are not going to get financed, and I'm not going to sell franchises. So, I mean, I think that you kind of don't use bank credit reports at your own peril, because, you know, they're becoming more and more popular for a reason. It's because that the banks are really relying on them. You know, we're really moving into a, you know, there's been a paradigm shift where you didn't need bank credit reports a few years ago because the banks were focusing more on the franchisees' qualifications and less on the historical success of the franchise company, and that's completely blown out of the water. And the bank, you know, is demanding more and more information from the franchise company to determine whether or not they're going to do this because the banks have become very conservative. And to tell the banks, you know, we're not going to do it, is telling the banks don't make the loan.
Well, that's interesting because when Paul and I attended the Small Business Lending Summit, one of the questions from the audience, and I believe it was from a franchisor to a banker, was, why can't there be more uniformity in the packaging of the loans between the various lenders? Why can't you guys, meaning the banks, ask for all the same stuff? And, again, I'm a proponent of the bank credit report. I recommend franchisors have a bank credit report. But that also goes in line with what you just described, that, you know, we might get to the point where we have more uniformity, which makes it easier for franchisees and with the guidance of the franchisors to shop lenders for the best deal and also for the person that will actually take them.
Yeah. And, I mean, the other thing, too, is, I mean, the uniformity aspect, I mean, I would say that the banking industry in general, and this has been even well before, even in the best of times, there hasn't been much uniformity in terms of underwriting criteria for these loans, where some banks, you know, if you don't fit exactly in the box that they want you to fit in, they're not even going to talk to you. And other banks, if you had a good story, you know, would sit and listen to you and it would be more creative. And I think it's just the personality of the lenders and stuff. It's become more uniform from the perspective of everybody's got more conservative because of what happened with the bottom falling out and the economy and so forth. But I think that while there might be a move towards more uniformity, I don't think you'll ever see it completely uniform because there's just such difference of personalities and risk tolerance and different things that people are looking for, and some banks may want a lot more information than other banks.
But there's still got to be coordination because if a franchisor is using the bank credit report to be able to help get funding for the franchisees,
mm-hmm.
need to know where the franchisee is actually submitting the loan so that that can get married up with their loan package.
Yes. Yeah, I mean generally, you know, if a bank, if a franchise company is working with FranData to create these bank credit reports, I mean, they're going to pretty much have everything teed up. So once the franchisee alerts the franchisor of where they're, you know, who they're talking to, you know, at that point, you know, the franchisor is going to be able to probably, with some modification, shoot that right out to whoever the franchisee needs to have it sent to.
Sure, definitely. I think we could do a whole show on bank credit reports for certain as we talk more
about franchise. I can tell you this, Paul. In attending, you know, session after session, year after year, I never saw more interest, and I think it was because it was really a new, unique session that had never been presented before at any of these types of symposiums. But it could have gone all day. I mean, it was definitely. We're actually probably going to be doing an FBN meeting on a similar topic, just based on how much interest there was.
Yeah, I mean, all the interest that came out of you know, the Small Business Lending Summit. I know the IFA was at another big summit in San Diego with respect to it. I mean, there's a lot of discussion, so there's no doubt that it was a hot topic. And
yep.
I wanted to touch on one more thing in your notes, and we could actually call this the putting the toothpaste back in the tube session.
Yep.
You have a section in your notes about remedying mistakes. And if you can kind of just give us a quick overview of what was discussed with respect to remedying mistakes.
Sure. Yeah, that was actually an interesting session because it's usually weaved in other seminars I've been to, but it was never just completely carved out and made into its own session. And, I mean, the general sense is, you know, that when it's brought to the attention of senior management, they're going to look at, you know, was the mistake before the person signed or after? Obviously, if it's before, then it's easier to deal with the toothpaste because all you got to do is fix it and redisclose them. If it's after, it's a different story, and at that point you have to look at was it material, was it willful, was it in a registration state or a non-registration state? And if it's in a registration state at that point, you know, depending on what the mistake was, you may need to approach the state examiners, you may need to offer a rescission. It's really going to depend. You've really got to look at how many franchisees were impacted by it. And, you know, generally the takeaway was that the, you know, the lawyers would give input on, you know, what the mistake was, the consequences for making this mistake, the consequences, you know, when you approach the franchisee and potentially state regulators, as well as the consequences for doing nothing, which can sometimes be a lot worse. And at that point, you know, senior management is going to make a decision as to what they want to do.
Sure. And we are running out of time, and I'm glad you were able to get that in. Joe, do you have any last comments before we get ready to sign off?
I just think I'd like to thank all of the attorneys that I've asked to be guests on the show and give them a thank you, and especially to you, Adam. We have you on today, and a great job, and we could probably go on another hour on things that I'd like to ask you, but we'll have you on again.
This has been my pleasure, and I look forward to it.
Thanks, Adam. Remember, today's show and all segments of Franchise Today are available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today Show. May also remind you to visit the Franchise Today Facebook page, and please like us. Next week, my guest is Michael Webster, franchisee attorney and strategic chair of the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers, as he brings us up to date on some of the issues within franchisee associations. And, of course, the topic of discussion is franchisee associations and why franchisors should love. Oh, until then, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. And Franchise Today is out.